close to the normal fraction of a milliwatt of a receiver stage. And I'm only running it at the 1 milliwatt level of signal going through it. And it's capable of transmitting 100 milliwatts, this transmitting transistor used in a receiver stage. If I designed a receiver with a whole lot of stages like that, the receiver is going to run hotter in physical temperature. It's going to draw more current as long as it's being fed by Con Ed or LiPa power. That's not a problem. As long as I got good enough heat sink, that's not a problem. I'm not going to be battery operating this thing. You design a receiver like that. In theory, you can make a receiver where you can be right next door to that repeater and you won't experience overload. It's possible. And on mil-spec jobs that I've worked on, we've done things like that. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say it's cheap. I didn't say it's efficient. I didn't say it's small. But it's doable. The science and art of good receiver design with high intercept concepts, high third order intercept, can make you take your third order intermodulation distortion signal and knock it down by 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 decibels with good design. It's definitely within the realm of possibility. Another approach, if you take a look back in the dark ages of 2 meter synthesized receivers, roughly 1985 time frame, Yaesu DC-345, 245, I don't know the model number of the darn thing, but there was a Yaesu synthesized rig that came out in the middle 80s, which in order to tune across the 2 meter band, let me drop, to go from 144 to 148, you had to switch in 5 different band switches. The first one went from 144 to 144.6, and the next one went from 144.5 to 145, and so on. So it's 4 or 5 different, or 6 different steps to the band switching. And that receiver had a tracking RF filter. As you tuned across the band with the great big VFO dial, not only were you tuning the receiver local oscillator and therefore determining what signal frequency you listen to, but you were simultaneously changing the voltage on the RF amplifier filter assembly that had varactor diodes in that filter and it tracked you. When you tuned to the 144.2 portion of the band, you had a bandpass filter there passing 144.15 up to 144.25 when you tuned to 144.20. There was a filter there that tracked whatever you tuned the receiver to. That receiver was reasonably bulletproof. You could be listening to 144.200 when there's a whopping big signal at 146 megs coming through, and that front-end tracking filter rejected it, and because it was an electronic tunable filter built into the front end of this rig, which, by the way, was twice the normal size of a desktop radio, but that's the way they were in 1985, that Yaesu rig really had extremely high dynamic range. Well, Japan soon recognized the fact that we amateurs are lazy. As we tune across the 2 meter band, we don't want to be operating a band switch. We just want to spin the great big VFO dial. Therefore, all the radios you buy today for the 2 meter band, with rare exceptions, the front end is broadbanded from 144 to 148 megacycles inclusive. The darn front end of the receiver is listening to everything on the 2 meter and band simultaneously. No tracking filter. Yes, it's easier to use as far as the knobs and buttons on the front panel are concerned, but you've given up something in the process. Maybe it's time we go back. Maybe it's time with modern-day computer-generated receiving techniques and the software-defined radios that we start requesting the tracking RF filter in the front end. It would eliminate the problem that Jim has brought to our attention tonight.
FT-221,
and it came out in 1976. That's the one. Thank you, Rich. FT-221R. 1976. Well, I laid my hands on one in roughly 1985. I bought a used one. 1976. Did you own one of those, Rich? Did you recognize how bulletproof it was compared to modern rigs? My only complaint about that rig is that in the sideband mode, the audio was a little bit mushy. It had upper sideband and lower sideband. I forget which one it was. I think the lower sideband motor had very mushy sounding audio. No high frequency notes in there. But other than that, in his day, that was a rather bulletproof receiver. Tell me of your experience with that DC-221R, N2EO, K2LAW in the tech net.
He said, yes, I own one. I bought one brand new. I had a Chanel 2-meter preamp on it. No intermod, no nothing. It was pretty bulletproof. What that receiver needed, what I did was to work in the ATC. The ATC was a little too fast. It would pump. So you had to slow down the ATC in that thing. But other than that, it was a great radio.
Okay. Did you have to add a preamp in front of it to get full sensitivity in the sideband mode? How much did it cost brand new? How long did you keep it? When did you sell it, so to speak? Give us a few more words. Did Barry have one? Over to you, Rich.
Oh, I had it a number of years. I don't remember what I did with it. I had a Chanel preamp on it. I think the radio was about $576. The Chanel preamp was about $20-$25. And it was, you know, I don't remember that much, but it did work very well. I did not have any intermod problems, because like you say, it had that tracking front end. It was a very good piece of equipment.
And refresh my memory, Rich. That band switch that allowed you to tune from 144 to 148, how many clicks did it have, that band switch, where you selected the individual section? The test number one. Number two, the Chanel preamp, I think that had a tube in it. What was the tube in that Chanel preamp? So, how many band switches did it have, Rich? Go ahead.
That was a solid-state preamp thing. That was, I think it used a MOSFET. The band switch, it was 500 kilohertz segments. So you would go 144 to 144.5, 144.5. I think there were eight. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there were eight segments. Does that sound right, Dick?
It sure does. A little bit of overlap. I think the first one went 144 to 144.6. And the next one probably went from 144.5 to 145 and so on. So eight band switches in that tracking filter receiver assembly. One of the first all connected together synthesized rigs, all mode. Before that, we were all using the GLB synthesizer. George L. Belke in Buffalo, New York, came up with this beautiful synthesizer that you plugged into your ordinary transceiver, and it plugged into the crystal socket. Before that, all of our frequencies were selected by a rotary dial that's a click-click switch that selected the right crystal inside your radio. We were all crystal controlled on 2 meters, with rare exception, except for the Clayton-Dewson interceptor, which had a little bit of drift. And so rather than buying a zillion crystals, in fact, everybody could tune into a couple of the repeaters, and nobody could tune into all of the repeaters in the mid-70s, because we didn't have enough money to buy all the darn crystals. And even if you did, there wasn't enough sockets in the rig to select all the crystals. And this guy, George Belke, had a great idea. He made a T-squared L, in other words, transistor-transistor logic circuit out of 5400 or 7400 series integrated circuits. He made this beautiful frequency synthesizer that plugged into your crystal socket, and it acted like 800 different crystals when you turn the rotary dials on it. And it had two sets of dials. Let me drop. It had one set of dials for the transmit frequency selection, another set of dials for the receiver frequency selection. So you didn't have to have 600 kc offset if you didn't want to. You could have 1 mega offset, 1.15 mega offset, whatever. You had independent control of the transmit frequency and the receive frequency on the front panel of the GLB synthesizer. I still own one of those. And in its day, it was a state-of-the-art design. I bet you owned one of those. And then right after that came out another rig that was nice and compact with it all built inside. Was it a KLM, KLH? What was the next rig that came after that, which had these a very interesting front panel dial where the outer knob was the kilohertz and the inner knob was the tens of kilohertz and so on, if you remember the rig I'm talking about, Rich? N2EO. reminiscing about the good old days, whatever that means. K2RIW, and set next.
KDK.
KDK, that was the one. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, that's
going
to say the KDK SM-144. I remember that. I did own one. I had a Clegg FM-27B, which was took a little bit of maneuvering to set up on three. It was a pistol plex. Remember that one, Vic?
I sure do. You did the equivalent of zero beating. You listened to a guy and you operated these knobs until a meter was zeroed in order to get it on frequency, as I remember. The crystal plexing rig, I think it was using rubberized rocks, was the Clegg FM-27B. Was it using a rubberized rock in there, Rich? Go ahead.
It was, Dick. You would select 10 kilohertz segments, and then they use the VXO into the in-between, and that's correct. You would dial up to the same frequency, you view it on the discriminator meter, you pull out the approach control with the spot switch, and you would spot the transmitter offset against the receiver for the zero on that meter.
And another rig that was popular way back in the 70s was the KLM Echo 70. I think there was an Echo 2, but the Echo 70 was a rubberized rock rig which transmitted single sideband on 432. And boy, I got a lot of use out of that between the mid-70s and the early 80s. When I was making all those 432 meg single sideband contacts with a guy in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles from me, day in and day out, for four solid years, summer, winter, spring, and fall. We just couldn't believe that those kind of distances, 480 airline miles. He was 200 miles inland in Greensboro, North Carolina, and 480 miles away was me up here on Long Island, with 16 Yagis on 100 feet of power on 432, transmitting down to his four Yagis on 100 feet of power, kilowatt on both ends, single sideband 432. And there were guys in between saying that, hey, these guys are making up a story here. They're not really talking to each other. They're on the telephone. Well, we did it for 4 years. That would be one hell of a phone bill. Eventually, people proved it. And if you go to the CQ magazine, March issue 2008, you can read the story about what I'm describing of these long-range Q-servers. And you'll see a picture of me on the tower and the antenna that did all that work. That was an Echo 70 transmitter made by KLM. Not a great rig. It had some residual FM, unless you had extremely well-regulated 12-volt supply going into it. It didn't put out, by modern standards, really hi-fi sideband. 10 watts output, which was enough to drive my 4CX250B pair tube amplifier, triple-line kilowatt amplifier, to 1,000 watts of input, 700 watts of output. So 700 watts of sideband on 432 into a 16 Yagi array, 304 elements total, 400 square feet of antenna, a 5,000 cubic foot of antenna sitting on top of a tower, roughly 29 dB of gain over isotropic. I was transmitting something close to 500,000 watts of effective isotropic radiated power. To transmit enough power with a big enough antenna, you can talk, my radio horizon was 40 miles away, and I'm talking to a guy 480 miles.
Repeater, timeout.
I talked to a man 480 miles away, more than 10 times beyond my radio horizon. People used to think. For reflecting signals off of airplanes, I thought to get the signal at 480 miles. That was the enhancement to 30 dB that we heard periodically. I'll admit this is real weak signal stuff. On average, he's only a couple of decibels above my single sideband threshold. And each QSO of about 2 minutes back and forth transmission would be what did you hear during the previous transmit period. And so we would experiment with antenna aiming and sideband versus Morse code, compare it summer, winter, spring, fall, rain or shine, snowstorm, thunderstorms, and so on. We saw all kinds of crazy characteristics. The signals would be the strongest in peak amplitude in the summertime with good tropo conditions. But those valleys were very strong in the summertime. The wintertime propagation, the signals averaged a weaker number, but they were more reliable. The nulls were not as deep. So you had a little bit more condensation in the wintertime, even though the signals on average were weaker. The crazy statistics of propagation. Anybody got any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me a call letter. K2RIW in the Tech Tag.
Myself and Barry used to communicate with KCPGP in Pittsburgh in those years, and we found the same thing. Conditions were up and down, we were getting airplane reflection. We kept pretty good communication with him. I don't remember his name or whatever became of KCPGP.
It turns out that Alan, K2UIH, used to also hold skids with him, mostly Moonbound skids. K3 Papa, Golf Papa. We'll soon find out who he is. John Urich in Irwin, Pennsylvania is where he is right now. You probably talked to John, you and Barry, quite a bit. And roughly how many miles was it from your QTH to Pittsburgh? He's in the Pittsburgh vicinity. Roughly how many miles is that airline distance, Rich, go ahead.
I think it was also about 400 miles, Dick. It was pretty close to the Ohio border where he was. And we communicated with him every night on 432. I think John was using a dish. Barry had, what does he have? I think he had a pair of Yankees. I had a single Yankee. I was running about 300 watts out on 432, and I had the Joe Riser cavity with the MRS-901 preamp.
At around that time, I also used to hold schedules with a guy in Romulus, Michigan. I think it was Whiskey Alpha 8 Golf Hotel X-Ray. He now changed his call letters. Just looked him up, and he's no longer the same guy. In fact, I ran into him at a microwave update not too long ago, and he was even a greater distance, and there wasn't as many aircraft flying that particular path. The path down toward Greensboro, North Carolina, the midpoint was Washington, D.C., and was it Annapolis, Maryland, but in that order. And so there's a whole lot of airplanes flying back and forth between New York and Florida going directly at high altitude over that point, giving us a beautiful reflection. Whereas when I started holding contacts, QSOs with this guy in Michigan, although he was using more antenna, it was a much more difficult path. More range, less airplanes. So we weren't quite as successful. And I also discovered that when Hurricane Gloria removed that antenna from the tower, that all of my FM8 foam-filled flexible cables were slowly migrating water, increasing the insertion loss. So the noise figure of my receiving system was really terrible by modern-day standards. I could have had a lot more fun if I had a better noise figure, but I found it out years afterwards. Oh well, you live and learn. Okay, is there anyone else with any further questions or comments before mail goes to his mailbag? It would be nice, for instance, to talk to Paul, WS2N. I hear tell that the Hubble Space Telescope is back in operation. The communication failure, they managed to repair it by one means or another. I have to go to the NASA website and find out about that. Anybody got any further comments on that? And if Paul is there, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I did have a question, Pete, to pick up Paul.
I think Paul's not with us tonight. And yes, I forgot that you've got a question. Rich, go ahead with your question.
Hey, Dick. I have a SD620 pan adapter hooked up to my power to KWM2. And the CRT, it's 7-5-0, long persistence, it's a CRT7 CRT. The CRT is kind of tired, and I priced them out. The original was an Hitachi, which is like $239 for that T-72 in Itachi. I found a company on the internet that I hope it's going to work for $69. A company that deals in surplus tubes, canned surplus, manufactured surplus. I found the 3RB7, but he said it's a company I never heard of called Raysonic, R-A-Y-S-O-N-I-C. Have you or Mel, have anybody ever heard of Raysonic? I don't know, maybe it's an OEM and they're just putting their name on it. He said it's an American-made tube. This guy is in British Columbia, Canada. He's shipping it this week. It was $69 for the tube, and I don't know why, but the Canadian Express Post is put it was $33. He is guaranteeing it. He said he'll guarantee that it works, and he'll guarantee it for 30 days. But has anybody heard of Raysonic? Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to pass out the word now. Anybody ever heard of a company called Raysonic who is shipping Rich A cathode ray tube? Give me a call at us right now. Yeah, maybe nobody knows of that company, Rich. I've owned one of those Heathkit pan adapters. It does a reasonably good job. One of the problems it had a very simple Cyrotron type of sawtooth generator that does the sweep. Some of the capacitors that did the coupling of signals for the sweeping, as I remember, became leaky, and you easily run into the problem where the centering controls run out of range, and you can't center the signal on the signal horizontally or vertically. You may have to do some capacitor replacement, because those leaky paper capacitors, I remember, that did the coupling were a bit of a problem. Also, cathode ray tubes are getting a bit obsolete. I know you'd like to return it to the original condition, and therefore you're going through the rigmarole of buying a substitute cathode ray tube. But modern day solid state flat screen displays, there's so many of them, it would be worth considering making a modification to the display. Also, you probably own an oscilloscope. It wouldn't be too difficult to rewire your horizontal and vertical deflection amplifiers of your oscilloscope to do the displaying of your pan adapter. The advantage you would get would be a much bigger screen. The disadvantage you would get would be no storage, I know. It's a slow painting phosphor that you were using where the signal persists on the screen for a while. And so that would be a little bit of a pain. I got to admit that one. And there's ways you can make a kind of a display. Putting the information slowly into a display matrix, but displaying the information out of the display matrix rapidly on the screen. And therefore, electronically, you're generating the equivalent of a long persistent phosphor. There are ways of doing that. I didn't say it's easy. I'll admit that if I was in your shoes, I'd go buy the cathode ray tube as long as I had reasonable assurance that it would fit in and work properly. And you may have to do a little bit of readjusting of control dip voltages and focus voltages and deflection voltages and whatever to make the new CRT work. My guess is it's a close substitute, but... not an exact replacement. Well, maybe it is. Give us some words on that one, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
Hey, you wanted to comment?
Okay, I'm
going to
let Mel go, but yes, it is the same tube. Right, for $239. This Raysonic, which is a new old stock, was $69. So I'm taking a chance. Let me turn it over to Mel, N2EM.
This is KTY. I did exactly what Dick said. I took that same piece of equipment, first went to the CRT, started to get a little flaky on me, and then the payoff was the power transformer started arcing. the high voltage winding side is the breakdown, which seems to be a common trait with that thing, but I've heard from a few people that have similar problems. So what I did is I wanted to still use it because I had it hooked on my Collins 7584 so I could just watch the panoramic display, watch the tip jumping on, so I didn't see two exact ports just the available on 18 or 6, basically. And I substituted, I had picked up a back with brand new, with a 50 megahertz dual channel scope made by Hitachi, same company Hitachi, you know, Swiss, Green, you know, beautiful traits on it, bright, beautiful traits on it. And that's what I did. In fact, I took out of the Hitachi the horizontal MV, the multi-vibrator, and substituted that also into the original heat, much better. The multi-vibrator in the Hitachi gave a much better be able to give me, a sharper peak. In other words, the tips were much more defined using the Hitachi source of horizontal multi-vibrator. Rather than have those broad type of tip display, this way it narrows down a little better and a little bit more stable. So overall, I dumped the cabinet and everything, and put the chassis out, put it in another nice box and everything like that. Never know what the original EVE gets. Back to you, Dick.
And your particular new display, was it a long persistence phosphor mel? And if not, how did you get around that problem?
I don't really need the long persistence. Yeah, I had that also, the long persistence. I was using that in practice for antenna measurement situation. But I have another scope back to the P7. I put a P7 tube in. I took out the P1. Actually changed the 5FP1 for 5FP7. A lot of them around. I use that for other testing on the antenna situation. But the brightness on that attaching, the intensity on this display is turn it up bright enough that I don't seem to miss that P7 deck. It's so much sharper and cleaner over.
Very tempting. Now, in the case of the very popular in the early 70s, Hewlett-Packard spectrum analyzer called 8555, which had a mainframe called 851, I think, it really had a variable persistence cathode ray tube. In other words, there was a knob on the front panel of that display, and the display itself was probably 5 or 6 inches in diameter. You could turn that knob and make the persistence of the phosphor go anything from 0 to many seconds. You could make it a storage scope, or you could adjust the delay such that as it swept across the screen, your signal would still be there, and it's just starting to fade as the next sweep comes along. Hewlett-Packard and Tektronix both had variable persistence spectrum analyzer displays, and adapting one of those to this function would be a little bit more fun, in my opinion. Nice big display, and now you can decide exactly how long each of the signals stays on the screen. The only way to go one step beyond that is the Hewlett-Packard 54120, I think it's called, sampling oscilloscope, where it puts millions of dots on the screen for each sample point. And by twisting the knobs, you can decide how long every one of those dots will persist, and then they wink out. And when they wink out, it looks just like that speckled display you get in a Star Trek television series where they're beaming down. That was a sampling oscilloscope. Very nice display. So, fun machines, pan adapter. Allows you to see the whole screen at once. Nowadays, the Spectran. I presume some guys are using Spectran software into a good audio board in a computer in order to make a panoramic display. I am guessing that's true. I wonder if anyone can confirm that for me. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Hey, why?
Go ahead, Mel.
You bring up that Hewlett-Packard tube. That tube was made, it was a French made, I'm trying to remember the company that made that tube. My early flow scan experiment, I used that tube, in fact, because I could adjust the persistence. And being that early flow scan was basically, you know, long persistence, the only way you could see it was on long persistence tubes, such as the T7 tube. But they had come out with that other one that, and I can't remember what tube that was, where that once the persistence was on the screen, it actually held. There was another a modification to that where you could hold it until you push the button to discharge it, Dick, over.
Yeah, believe it or not, the variable persistence 851 and that series of displays, when you turn the knob for persistence all the way up, you've got to make sure that you paint the dot in a way that it's not too bright so that it doesn't balloon. You can get persistence that will be many minutes, if not longer. So those variable persistence tubes are kind of fun. Nowadays, the electronic equivalent of that can do a much better job, where when you're using a, what's the model number? 8551? Nope. I think it's 8551. 8566 spectrum analyzer has an electronic variable persistence display where everything that gets painted on the screen in the slow sweep mode stays there forever, and only the next sweep changes the display a 16th of an inch ahead of the new sweep, if you know what I mean. You can see a little bit of a notch walk across the screen as the new sweep is being painted onto the display matrix. The display matrix is a digital display device which is being read in slowly with information, but read out rapidly for the screen. The screen is being painted 30 or 60 times per second, and you see no flicker. So the modern day electronic and the display itself also it happens to be what they call a, not a was, were, what do they call it now? Has been, I'm trying to think of the crazy words they use for it. In other words, there's a fancy set of words they use for the method by which it stores information and displays them. And so what it's really doing is that there's 1,024 individual horizontal positions on the screen. All the odd ones, it displays the peak signal it saw during that interval. All the even ones, it displays the valley signal. Therefore, you do get a display that looks like normal noise, whereas most variable persistence displays make an extremely smooth-looking line, which looks unnatural when you're used to using ordinary non-variable persistence display-type spectrum analyzers. I'll think of a set of words in a minute for the name for that function that Hewlett-Packard invented. Now back to you, Mel. Drag your feet a little bit in case anyone else has any further questions, and if not, maybe it's time we open our mailbag. K2KEY with a little delay. K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. All right. The type of display you're thinking of is called CFT, thin film transistor display. And oh yeah, they got a lot of magic. That really are quite amazing. You know, I have a Tektronix DSO digital storage oscilloscope, and it's fine once you get used to using things like that. In fact, the one I have with a few people was one of their last that used a regular CRT, something you can't find no more. These new type of CRT displays, like these CFTs and all. I don't know, Dick. Might just from the old school, but for some reason, just don't desire them over.
I heard an extremely weak signal, and we didn't get a word out of it. Want to try again?
Okay, James.
I heard only one or two letters. I think it's KE2EJ. I use slowly moving into a better position. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, give me a couple minutes and I'll be in a better place. I got some things to say about it.
You were dead full quiet in that time. Go ahead and say a few things.
Yeah, well, you know, the days of the CIT have finally gone. None of the scope manufacturers use them anymore. We're doing stuff like digital phosphor oscilloscopes. Many of the spectrum analyzers has EFT displays in it. And what I've got to say is you can actually make a panel. Well, that person, can you hear me?
We're hearing you very well. Please proceed.
Okay. If you're into using computers, and maybe a little more than that, you can do some very basic programming. There are display packages that you can get. You can take yourself a nice little A to D and wire that up, or you can actually even buy them already built and make yourself a nice little pan adapter looking into the IF of your receiver. Actually, I picked this in QEX. I don't remember how long ago, but there was a pan adapter spectrum analyzer type display. It uses a solid state display. Actually, this particular one I think you use a computer. And the electronics for it is relatively simple and easy to build. But CRTs are the thing of the past these days. I mean, even if you go to buy a television, you can't even find a picture tube anymore. And the reason for that...
My guess is the reason for that, you were starting to say, because of toxic waste. Is that true, Eric? And by the way, 60 Minutes had a special issue of that exact subject tonight, an hour or two ago. Over to you, Eric.
Roger, Dick. Yeah, it's the problem is the lead is one problem because when you have high voltages, you generate X-rays, and most people don't realize it.
A real good cathode ray tube is running at numbers like 30,000 volts, and it is making soft X-rays, and by putting enough lead into the glass to absorb those X-rays, it becomes safe for human consumption. And the 60 Minutes program tonight had a special issue on the subject of a very green-sounding company in California that was collecting, they won the contract at various towns to collect the electronic waste to recycle it, but they in turn were shipping it by containerization to Hong Kong or someplace in China, and it was becoming toxic waste and really contaminating the soil and poisoning the people in that area, and there's some definite laws against doing that. And they discovered 42 different American companies are doing that, even though it's illegal. By way of the 60 Minutes program, a few of those people are going to have some fancy questions to answer. So cathode ray tubes are a bit of a problem. They still are the highest dynamic range display, although some of the other flat screen displays are coming up real fast in performance. So as Eric is saying, cathode ray tubes are almost obsolete. You almost can't buy them anymore. And they're a real pain when it comes to disposing of them. And most of the other flat screen displays are not quite that bad. By way of digital techniques, you can get variable persistence. Let me drop. And I just thought of the name of the very fancy circuitry that's built into the Hewlett-Packard 8566 spectrum analyzer. That's a mid-80s vintage spectrum analyzer, very high in performance. I must have used 100 of those in my time, 100 different serial number 8566s throughout the years that I was using them. If you tickle the keys properly on that machine, my goodness, can that do magic. Anyhow, it has something called the Rosenfeld detector. Rosenfeld sounds like a man's name. It is not a man's name. It is the past tense of the word rise and fall. Past tense of rise is a rose, and past tense of fall is fell. Rosenfeld detector. And so the Rosenfeld detector had that characteristic I mentioned to you earlier, where the odd number 1024 horizontal positions, it would record the peak and display it. The even numbers would record the valley, and therefore the display itself, even though it was a electronic variable persistence-like display, the noise looked like noise. However, if you dig into the nitty-gritty, the noise had the wrong characteristic. Each of the peaks were a peak for that interval, each of the valleys were a valley, and the distribution in between was nonlinear. So if you simply digitized those display positions, and by the way, that spectrum analyzer had a continuously running parallel, what was it now, 8-bit analog-to-digital converter that ran in there, taking something like 3 million samples per second. So everything on that screen was roaring out of the back panel, out of the parallel streaming port, giving you the digital display, giving you the display in digital numbers. And I was coming up with mathematics to analyze the display distribution functions, and I suddenly realized it had this really crazy function because of the Rosenfeld. The spectrum analyzer always wakes up with the Rosenfeld detector engaged. And if you use the pull-out card on the analyzer and punch the buttons the right way, you can make it now a normal Gaussian distribution display or a normal sampling function display and bypass the Rosenfeld detector. You'd be amazed how many electronic engineers using that spectrum analyzer never knew that. And there are some cases where... There were some cases where it gave them a good-looking answer, but it wasn't the accurate answer. So, what's your favorite kind of variable persistence display, Eric? What's it called, and which one of the machines that you use owns it? KE2EJ, K2RIW for TechNet.
All right, K2RIW, can you hear me, first of all?
Loud and clear, go right ahead.
All right, I use my favorite spectrum analyzer, something called the Advanced Test, ESC. It's distributed by Tektronix. It's made by, I think it's made by Sony. Advanced Test is actually the company. This particular spectrum analyzer actually goes up to 40 gigs, so, you know, it's a little bit pricey. But it's got a TFT display and a whole series of mathematical functions that you can perform. And how it does its display. So everything really is captured in memory, and that memory, that page of memory, is then transferred to the display. And you can control the persistence, how fast it decays. You can do FFTs, even though the thing is an FFT. You can do peak averaging, voltage measurements. You know, because everything is turned into numbers, and by the way, it's got a very wide bandwidth. A to D, final IF. It is a very accurate device, and don't forget, it goes to 40 gigs, so, you know, it's a multi-stage spectrum analyzer. It's invisible to you, but, you know, to have circuitry that goes from 0 to 40 gigs is not quite that practical. But their IF, their high IF is a bit higher than 40 gigs, but not much. Anyway, it's a beautiful device. The display is color. It's false color, of course. You can make it any color you want. You can make multiple phases, multiple colors, so that you can keep track of things that are going. But other than that, I keep my trusty old 2715 handy with its storage scope, which also has a map memory, but it also gives you 8 channels of storage, so you can... you know, pop up your displays anytime. It comes up on real phosphorus. It doesn't have the rise and fall thing like the Hewlett Packard does. They have their version of it. P2RIWK.
Yeah, I bet you your favorite Avantech or Advantech, I think you pronounced it, also has a so-called sampling function, integration function. I forget what they call it, but it really is a spectral overlay. In other words, you can decide how many sweeps are going to be integrated. I quite often would set it for 100 consecutive sweeps of integration. And so each of the 100 sweeps went into storage. And so at each individual horizontal position, it would average all of the individual 100 numbers and display it. So the net result after 100 sweeps is that even though signal you're looking at was noisy in nature, if there really was a hidden piece of mathematics to it, so to speak, after 100 consecutive sweeps of spectral overlays, it would present as an extremely smooth display, and therefore if your particular power supply, running on 60 cycles, has a 6,000th harmonic coming out of the power supply, going into a voltage-controlled oscillator, and making a little bit of a wiggle on the spectral purity display, the sideband, you know, 1.5 megacycles off to one side, you can easily display that little bitty sideband that's sticking up there 1 dB out of the rest. I mean, when you do 100 integrations, you can see some very fine details that are absolutely hidden from you under normal circumstances. I bet you've used that function a few times, Eric. Go ahead.
Actually, if you have a laptop like I do and you have a little bit of software with it, you can actually write your own algorithm as to how you want it to capture data. And in the case of the transmitters, we young with a few other people who are doing pretty much trying to do the same thing. We came up with a program, which is a series of summations and a couple of integrations. It actually works for something that's very, very hard to see in the transmitter, especially if you've got something that's internally guided. There is a beat note that is 920 cycle, and it shows up as a very slight bit of herring bone in the picture. So you can always tell when you're looking at something that's externally diflexed or internally diflexed. You look very carefully at the analog picture towards February 17th. Why bother? Because they won't be there. But it's an interesting device that you can actually do that sort of thing.
Sounds like fun. Eric, are you going to be able to keep track of the latest and the greatest, the highest, what's the word I'm looking for, generation? I guess we're in the sixth generation or the seventh generation now of compensating digital front end for high-def television or digital television. Will you be able to keep track of what brand name of converter or what brand name of receiver has the best characteristics so that as February 17 approaches, the smart guys listening to this net will know exactly which brand to buy. And all you have to do is announce that you're going to be coming out with those numbers. Obviously, the major brands of television sets will be bribing you, putting a whole lot of money in your hand, making sure that you say positive things about their particular brand. K2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, K2EJ. That's getting to be a problem. The market is getting saturated with names that I've never heard of anymore. And I have no idea what to decide, but as time moves on, and as people actually start to try and pick up digital, I'm beginning to feel sorry for people on Long Island, because digital don't work too well anymore. They did something to the antenna up there, and that really, excuse my language, but I'll find another explicit that I could actually say, but I can't say it, but you get the idea. They went from having a really gorgeous, beautiful, wonderful signal to I can hardly pick up anything in plain view anymore, especially the channels that I'm really interested in. So the guys up at Empire have their work cut out for them. And by the way, if you take a look at the Empire State Building, you'll see like two little L brackets on the 81st floor. It looks like a carpeted square, and those are the standby UHF for the digital. And they work pretty hard, by the way. But the main antennas don't work anywhere near as well as the old antenna that they took down. So, there are actually an interesting limited drop. Up at 13, my counterpart there actually got a case of converters from the Chinese manufacturer. They cost like about $40 a piece. And I tested them, and they kind of look so-so. They're not the best, they're not the worst, but there seems to be an awful lot of mixture at this point. And by the way, don't let anybody fool you. Digital television still doesn't work well. Not like your analog thing. It works. You know, I probably get soap put in my mouth for saying this, but there's a lot of folks have a lot of problems with trying to pick it up. If you're close in, if you're near the city, you've got no problem. If you're starting to go away from it, there's issues. And if you look at the cities without done the phony analog loss and check the receivers out, they've gotten their phone calls. We did a soft test last week, actually, and you're going to be starting to see it more and more. There'll be this thing that comes on your analog computer and says, your program's been interrupted. If you don't have a converter, you're not going to be able to watch the TV. It was a two-minute test. I think there's another one coming up next week, and they're going to try and do it two or three times a week. All the broadcasters haven't quite decided on the schedule yet, but it's coming. KQRI doesn't care. Who we owe, Jay?
Rich recognized. Interesting information, Eric. Eric, on a quick break, roughly what day did they change the antenna from the one that you like to the one that you're not as happy with? And you said on Long Island we're not getting as good a signal. I presume you're talking about either signal strength or some kind of distortion within the signal. And since you zeroed in on Long Island, does that mean in some other direction it's working better, or you're just somewhat unhappy with that antenna because of its group delay, distortion, or multipath, or signal strength, or whatever? So when did that antenna get changed? Back to you, Eric.
No, it's been about, I guess it's been about 6 weeks now, 8 weeks. But Brooklyn gets a wonderful signal because they put these auxiliary antenna into that at Brooklyn. And I think what's happening is that as you put your RF signal, if multiple antennas, you wind up with holes because they're not principally in phase, although they're supposed to be. Right, and now with digital, with one of the things that the RF engineers sometimes remember is that you may be perfectly 0 degrees in phase, but you'd be out of this time.
Absolutely, and then you get inter-symbol distortion. So total time delay as well as phase matching has to be done. On top of that, if there are antennas that are squirting down below the umbrella, so to speak, into Brooklyn for short-range response, and we out here in at the edge of Suffolk County are seeing both antennas simultaneously, and depending on what azimuth I've got, I'm seeing those antennas at leading or lagging phase, I'm getting inter-symbol distortion. And I think you're saying my converter has to either work super hard or it's going to give up and say, forget it. Now, when I was last at your point of place of business, and you were running a digital converter, you had that beautiful display showing me what all the taps were doing. How did you do that? Is that a special piece of test equipment that you attach to your particular converter? Or is there a way that I can request that with a piece of software on my digital converter, digital TV converter, and I can display it on my laptop computer? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
All right, KQRIW, KQEJ. The device that you were seeing, the actual tap to the equalizer, okay, that's a cheap device. That device retails for $9,500. That's cheap. That's inexpensive. Actually, that was built by Eric Small. You may know, if you know anything about FM and FM stereo, you should know that name. But he and the other gentleman that created a company called, they're like the number one stereo excited manufacturers in the world. He split from them and started his own company, which is called MSI, the Modulation Sciences Incorporated. And they are the two primary providers of stereo generators for both analog television and FM stereo. Anyway, at his device, he was going to use the fifth generation equalizer, except that you can't get access to the map, so he wound up using a third generation equalizer that allows you to see what's going on. And, you can actually, there is a little portable device that you can plug into the USB port on your computer, and I think there's three manufacturers that make them, and you can actually see what the caps are doing, you can see what the front end is doing, you can see what the error rate is. Give me a minute and I'll think of the name of the company. KQRIW, KQRIW.
fine. Now, I think you are estimating, though, that this condition we've got right now, where either Long Island or maybe other azimuth directions are not getting proper digital coverage with this compound antenna system at Empire, does the powers that be know about that and they're working on it? Is there a solution on the way? What do you think, Eric?
I think they're getting to the point where they're getting ready to ignore it. Because they've pretty much finished with what they've done, although they have been looking at the ABS form, which is pretty much the only way they get feedback these days. Actually, ever since the beginning. If you ever go to the ABS forum, you'll find that there's lots of really good, interesting stuff. These are like TV and hi-fi buffs, this particular board is. And it's a great site, and people tend to be out of anonymous, but all the broadcasters tend to have a look to see what's going on. And when they first put the antenna up, and it was really, really bad, they saw it show up on the ABS forum site. And then they made some improvements, and people said, yeah, it's better, but it ain't one of your things.
Okay, we got a little bit of a problem with phonetics now. You keep saying ABS forum site, or ADS. Is that Alpha Victor Sierra forum site? Go ahead.
AlphaVictorSierraForum.com.
Okay, AlphaVictorSierraForum.com. I should know, what does Alpha Victor Sierra stand for? Advanced Video System or something like that? Go ahead.
Sorry, audio video system.
Okay, audio video system. So I think you're saying if you're a real broadcast enthusiast and you go to that site, you'll find out what's the latest and the greatest in the metro area. Now, the problem you're indicating on the digital television receiving, transmitting antenna at Empire, is the problem more difficult on certain channels than others, or are you somewhat displeased on what it's doing on many of the channels simultaneously? Over to you, Eric.
Well, you know, I haven't been up there lately to see what's going on. I'm only getting secondhand information from the guy I talk to. And sometimes he's got little blank holes. He's really not in the loop, you know, yet. He goes and asks what's going on, but this is kind of lost a little bit of it. So he's always had trouble. He's in the sequence, so I guess he's another frustrated guy. And he takes care of the I don't know exactly what to say, Dick. I mean, I know what the other antennas used to do, and I also know why they went to this broader system. But don't forget, everybody's on a different frequency. You can't have an antenna that's perfectly quiet across, say, from 600 megs down to 400 megs to 500 megs. Each channel has its own issues and its own visual. It is a multi-port combiner that's tuned. And now that everybody on the 17th will be changing what channels they transmit on, you know, it was really designed for the end result changes of frequency, not what's currently there. Where, say, for example, channel 15 was at 61, I can no longer get my receiver to lock up. Although I have to put a preamp on it to get the hell of it to see what I can get out of it. It really isn't signal strength. I think it's I'm not getting past the trellis in the first place. But I have a device which I'm actually in the city.